where there's news all the time and horrible slants on normal news stories, there's two people who just try not to do that. And that's us.
And that's us. It's Emily and James, your friendly podcasters, back with another bomb interview.
Hey, but just how are things going, Emily? You good? Just it's always good to check in.
I'm good. I'm feeling invigorated. I feel like I've got lots to do.
Yes.
I just added a monthly donation to my monthly donation list for the organization that we're talking to.
Oh, that's perfect. I love that.
And that's not even like a planned plug.
No.
Well, like, I mean, it kind of is in the sense that it's related, but it's not like...
We're like, hey, guess what? And we're not like nudging you in the arm about it. But yeah, we are talking to a wonderful organization, End Citizens United. This is just something that we should be thinking about. And I'm excited that we had a chance to speak to the president of this organization. So that's even more exciting.
Yeah. And I'm also excited how it riffs on an earlier interview from this season. Topic wise, it kind of circles back a little bit to our conversation with Hedrick Smith. So, and I think it's an important topic as we gear up for November.
Absolutely. So guys, stick around for our amazing interview with End Citizens United. Okay, everyone. This week we have a wonderful topic to talk about, which is Citizens United, something that is kind of behind the scenes. Not a lot of people have it in the forefront of their mind, but there is a group called End Citizens United that we are lucky to talk to today. So please welcome Tiffany Muller, who is the president and executive director of End Citizens United. How you doing, Tiffany?
Doing great, doing great. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Great. It's really an honor to have you on today because, you know, we've talked a little bit about the election season coming up. So it is a very important time with the midterms happening. And something that does seem to come up, it doesn't get the most light, but it does come up, is campaign financing. And there's a whole history behind Citizens United and what it is. And do you mind just giving us a little bit of background on what this initiative was?
No, I'm happy to. So Citizens United is actually a Supreme Court decision that was decided in January 2010, and it actually took two really terrible ideas and merged them together. It said that money equals speech and corporations are people, and basically they used that to put a for sale sign on our government and to let corporations and other interest groups spend unlimited and often undisclosed money to influence our elections. And what we've really seen since that time is this 900% increase in the amount of money that outside interest groups are spending in our elections. 900% in just a few short years. And what it means for everyday Americans is that instead of one voice, one vote, and your vote and your voice being just as powerful as anyone else's, what we really know is that those who are writing the biggest check are getting the biggest say in our democracy right now.
And that's, you know, it's interesting to hear how we can kind of deceive the public a little bit, right? So you think your vote counts, and then you all of a sudden you realize that, oh, a vote can be bought, and a vote can, you know, all of a sudden, like, it's up for grabs. Like you said, America's for sale in a way. And, you know, how is something that's so, it seems so transparent that this is something against the public interest. So how did that, you know, get through? And, you know, are people aware that that's what happened when this was decided by the Supreme Court?
Court decisions often aren't followed by the everyday public. And we know that only about 20% of Americans actually know what the Citizens United decision did. But here's what we know. We do know that 93% of Americans think that our government is working for just a few big interests. And we know that the vast majority of Americans blame money and politics for the dysfunction and the gridlock that we see in Washington right now. And we've seen this play out over a number of cycles, but let's just talk about 2016 for a minute. We saw Bernie Sanders talking about being powered by individuals and not PACs and not special interests. And everyone remembers talking about $27, his average contribution. And it was about individuals coming together and taking on those big special interests and taking back our democracy. So we know that this is a really powerful issue. And what we're excited about is that actually there are a lot of candidates running across the country who've made this a priority and who want to come to Washington to make changes to our system and to reform our system so that it works more for you, not for just the special interests.
And so I'm taking a look at your website, and for our friends listening, that's just incitizensunited.org. Very easy to remember. And I'm on the, you know, take action page. Can you walk us through these, you know, different specific things that our listeners can actually do and engage in this topic? Because I think we all generally I really am resonating with what you're saying, that everyone generally understands that it's a problem, but we also all don't really necessarily understand what a solution might look like.
Well, first and foremost, we need to change who's making the decisions about who gets to have voice in our system. So right now, there are 20 really good pieces of legislation sitting in Congress that would actually help make the system better, that would close loopholes that are letting foreign money get into our system, or that would make sure that every dollar spent in an election is fully disclosed. Because guess what? I think if you have to watch those negative ads that are going to run on TV all the time, you should at least know who's paid for them.
Absolutely.
Right? And some of these other just really common sense pieces of legislation and incentivizing small dollar donors. But here's what we lack right now. We lack the leaders in Congress who have the spine to get it done. So first and foremost, what we know is that we need people who will help elect these champions of campaign finance reform that you can also find on our website. And these are people who are making this a central part of their campaign and who want the very first thing that they do when they come to Washington is to pass reform measures so that we can restore the power to you. Also, on your page, on the page that you were talking about, our Take Action page, there's links and resources to help individuals call their members of Congress, call their senators, write letters to the editor, learn more about what's going on in our system, tell us how you feel about campaign finance reform, and even get a free In Citizens United sticker, because we love a good swag as much as the next person.
We do too. We love a good piece of swag. And so I'm curious, what do we think is like a fair number to spend on a campaign, you know? So because there is a certain element of this that is important, because we do want the maximum amount of Americans to know who is running. So there's a certain element of that that is going to cost money. Is there a number that In Citizens United is comfortable with when it comes to, like, let's say someone's running for president, what is the number that they should, that is the ideal scenario that they should be spending on that campaign?
Well, here's what we think. Rather than a very specific number, we know that because of decisions like Citizens United, that in these races, about 67 to 75% of the spending in these races isn't by candidates. It's actually by these outside groups. Let me give you an example. Last cycle in the New Hampshire Senate race, there was $125 million spent. $125 million in a state that has only 1.25 million people.
Wow.
And of that, isn't that crazy? Of that $125 million, only $30 million of it was actually spent by the candidates themselves, about $15 million for each candidate. And that's still a lot of money for each candidate. But that means that $95 million was spent by outside interest groups that were just running negative and oftentimes false ads against these candidates. So right, like one of the first things we need to do is get that money out, because yep. that's going to bring down the overall cost of our campaigns. The other thing we believe, we're completely funded by the grassroots. We have 4 million people across the country who are members of In Citizens United. Our average donation is only $14. We know that when people join together, they can actually take on the big money. And so we believe and support a public financing option that would actually empower small dollar donors and would force candidates, instead of just going and raising money from big corporations or from the wealthiest people, it would actually incentivize them to go raise small dollar donors and talk to more people and get people off the sidelines and engaged in their democracy. And we think that's a healthier way to run our election.
I completely agree with you. And speaking of healthy elections, I'm very curious for people who may not know. We always talk about PACs and super PACs, right, in these situations that are financing these candidates. Do you think these political action committees, do you think they are inherently bad? Or do you think that some of them are, you know, they're doing it the right way, perhaps if they're, you know, disclosing what they're doing with this money? But do you think inherently the system of using PACs are a good thing?
So there's a little bit of, we kind of, since Citizens United, we actually call everything a super PAC. And one of the things that we know is that actually a lot of these organizations are what we call dark money organizations, who are actually not super PACs, but they're 501c4 organizations that are supposed to benefit the social welfare and the public good, and instead are taking in unlimited amounts of money and then not disclosing their donors. Super PACs also take unlimited amounts of money. Neither group can coordinate with candidates, but we know that that coordination is still happening too often. This unlimited and undisclosed money into our system is really what's drowning out the voices of everyday Americans. And we believe in limits and full disclosure. And one of the things that we've seen are candidates across the country really taking bold leadership and going a step beyond and taking their own, basically taking a pledge that says, I'm not going to take any corporate PAC money because I think corporations right now have an outsized influence in our country. And so I'm going to make sure that the voters of America or the voters of my district know that I'm going to stand for them and not for these special interests who are trying to buy access and buy results in Congress. And so we actually, there are 110 candidates right now running in the general election who have taken a no corporate PAC pledge. This is amazing. In 2016, I only know of like a handful, five that did it in 2016. And we've gone from five to 110. And it's because it matters to voters. And it's because voters are so tired of the system as it is.
I think that's amazing. And I think it's a testament to your work and our citizens really trying to understand, you know, where this money is coming from, because it's increasingly complicated, right? Because there's some PACs that I'm like, great, they're doing good work, like keep going. But also, like, even if I agree with that particular PAC, you know, they're convoluting the ecosystem, right? With campaign finances and how much access, you know, everything you just said, basically. I'd try to summarize it, but you did it much better than I. So it's interesting.
Yeah, we think that there's a real difference between these ideological value-driven PACs, uh-huh. one of them, right? Who have limits and who have full disclosure and who are really basically bringing together small dollar donors to try to have a voice and to be able to compete against these big money interests. There's a real difference between that and, let's say, a corporate PAC that's controlled by corporate executives that's completely basing their decisions on what's going to help their bottom line. And when we're seeing tax reform bills where 83% of the benefits go to corporations and Republican lawmakers admitting that they were told by their donors, pass this bill or don't come asking for more money. Or when we see, you know, Betsy DeVos, who is a big mega donor and whose family runs a big super PAC, jam through taking away the loan forgiveness program for students who were defrauded about student loans, and she took that away in order to help big banks, right? Like, this is what our system has come to right now.
And so for the candidates that and Citizens United favors, the ones that you've sought out, the ones that you've decided these people are doing it the right way, these people are working for the American public and their interest, what are they doing differently? How did you find them? Or maybe they found you, but what are these people doing that is that makes them a more qualified and better, essentially a morally better candidate for the American public?
Well, first and foremost, they want to overturn Citizens United. Look, we have to, that's just the first step. We need to have rules and limitations and full disclosure and transparency in our system. But additionally, all of these candidates have agreed to support measures that would help fix the system today, whether that's disclosure and transparency, closing loopholes that let foreign money in, strengthening the Federal Elections Commission, strengthening punishments for people who break the law, and incentivizing small dollar donors, like we've talked about. Additionally, we have out of those 110 candidates that we talked about, I think 85 of them are in Citizens United endorsed candidates who have chosen to forego corporate PAC money, or some of them have also gone further and are also rejecting federal lobbyist money. What we're seeing is a real passion around these issues. And they're out on the ground. They're talking to voters about this. Voters bring it up as a big concern to them about that the culture of corruption we're seeing in Washington is being fed by the big money in politics. So they're addressing, you know, how they're going to clean up Washington by talking about, like, first, we have to get rid of the money and how it's corrupting the system.
Now, a glaring observation, if you go, again, go to the NCitizensUnited.org website and go to their candidates page, one thing I do notice is majority, if not all of the people on this endorsed page are registered Democrat. Is this something that is not across the aisle? Are we finding that it's mostly Democrats that are you know, trying to get essentially, let's call it clean money? You know, if they're trying to do it the right way, and is this something that Republicans are not pursuing? Like, why is there a discrepancy here?
Well, what we know is that the only place this is partisan is in the halls of Congress. Voters across the country, Republicans, independents, Democrats, all know that there's way too much money in politics. They all want to overturn Citizens United. 78% of Republicans want to overturn Citizens United. And, you know, even Donald Trump used this messaging in his campaign about how he was going to drain the swamp and how he had given donations in order to get elected officials to do what he wanted because he knew how to play the system. So we know that this is an issue that voters across all aisles really, really care about. The problem is that currently the Democratic Party is the party that is trying to clean up the system, fight for disclosure and transparency. And right now, frankly, the Republicans are not coming to the table. As a matter of fact, they're trying to make the system worse. They just passed a rule that allowed for some of the organizations that aren't disclosing their donors to actually, what little bit of disclosure they had to do, they're trying to take that away. They're trying to take away a 60-year-old rule about not allowing churches and charities to do political work. They're trying to repeal that.
What?
Which would basically let the Koch brothers do political work through a charity and get a tax write-off for it.
Oh, come on.
Wait,
I know. Can you believe that?
I my gut reaction in my head when you just said that was like, leave Jesus out of this. Jesus does not want to be involved with campaign finances. Sorry, you are on a lovely roll.
It's so true.
he wants no part of this.
So true. So, you know, what we know is that voters are with us, and I think that the way that we end up convincing Republican lawmakers to be with us is to show them how powerful this issue is, for all of us to speak up, to speak out, to show how powerful it is at the ballot box in November, and to call and to write your representatives, because they need to hear that they're going to be held accountable if they continue to try to do this.
Yeah, no, I love those action items, and I think they're really clear. And I'm still, you know, really inspired by that 110 candidates number that you gave us earlier. And so I know from some of our fellow activists that we've interviewed, like for Drain the NRA, you can go to drainthenra.org and see if your candidate has taken money from the gun lobby. And so I'm curious if there's a resource so for our listeners that where they can type in their person's name and see how many, you know, how many dollars they've accepted from various PACs or super PACs, and then try to keep those candidates accountable for where that money's coming from. Do you know of any sort of online database or resource that people can use?
That's a really fantastic question. Yeah, I recommend that people go to Open Secrets. No, I think it's opensecrets.org, and it is a wonderful place to find out how much money your representatives are taking from different, not only just from business interests, but different sectors and industries. How much are they taking from pharmaceutical companies? How much are they taking from big banks and financial investment companies? All of those things are available on Open Secrets. It's a really fantastic resource. The other one is MapLight. MapLight also allows you to look up your representative and to see how much money that they have taken from different types of industries and sectors and lobbyists. And that way, you know, folks can go and find out for themselves and then hold their representatives accountable.
And on the flip side of that, we were lucky enough that you sent us a couple of wonderful articles and pieces of information. So we will post this eventually when this episode airs. But we have a link here from USA Today where it says Democratic PAC and Citizens United names Big Money 20 targets for 2018, and it's listing 20 of, and I'm going to quote you, Tiffany, here. We say these are the worst of the worst in Congress. So these are people who are taking all this money. We're talking about Senator Ted Cruz, House Speaker Paul Ryan, Representative Mike Bishop of my home state, Michigan, which I'm not proud of. But, you know, there are people, you know, they're almost like in your backyard. You know, they're taking all of this money that is not necessary. And it's a really interesting list. So, again, we're going to post this. But, you know, when you call some of these people out, you know, is there any shame? Is there any, you know, transparency? What are they saying when you're listing it right in front of them? Look, you're taking all of this money and you're taking it from all of these outside influences, and you're not working in the public interest. What are these people saying when you call them out like this?
Well, oftentimes what they say is that they need all the money they can get to run these campaigns. And then the other thing that they say is that the money they take doesn't influence their vote. And I think
that's hilarious.
I think voters see through both of those arguments, right?
I feel like that is a SNL skit waiting to happen, because that sentence doesn't make any sense.
That would be a good SNL skit.
We'll call them and propose it and fly you in.
I think good. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we were joking around here the other day that if they truly believe that this money doesn't influence their vote or who has access or what they think about an issue, then maybe they should just start putting all of those contributions into a blind trust so that they can't see who's giving it, and see how that works for them. But look, here's what we know about Washington. I was actually a chief of of staff on the Hill. I've seen this firsthand. And what happens is that lobbyists and corporations and special interests give money so that not only can they, you know, advocate a certain bill or position, but more importantly, so that they have access. And so they're the ones that members of Congress are being inundated with over and over and over. And so what that does is that shapes not only the outcome, but it actually shapes what even gets on the agenda, right? Mm-hmm. And so we end up talking a lot more on Capitol Hill about the carried interest tax loophole that benefits the super wealthy rather than the mortgage interest deduction that helps the middle class family. Because it's all about who's driving the debate, who's driving the agenda, and whose interests are being watched out for.
In that answer, you quickly dropped when I was chief of staff on the Hill. And so now I just want to, I'm curious, that sparked a question in my head. You know, at what point in your career, because I mean, I've read your bio, we'll include it for all the listeners. You know, at what point in your career from Kansas to that position or your current position, were you like, this is my fight? You know, when did the spark shift from working in politics to I am personally fully invested, taking a full-time job in ending Citizens United?
So I actually feel that I've done this, first of all, great question, and thank you. I feel like I've done a real circle in my career. The very first thing I ever did in politics was actually a grassroots-led campaign as an openly gay Democrat woman in Kansas to add, to expand our anti-discrimination ordinance in Topeka, Kansas. And Topeka, awesome. Kansas is home to the Westboro Baptist Church, which goes around the country and pickets about God hates fags. And that was the kind of environment. And this is early 2000s. And so we actually went door to door with volunteers and talked to individual members of our community about why we thought that gay people, like myself, shouldn't be fired from their job just because they were gay. And it was such a lesson in how people can come together and actually change a system and change policy and change the outcome. And it took 2 years, but we actually eventually did expand the anti-discrimination ordinance there in Topeka, Kansas. And when placed on the ballot for repeal, we actually were able to successfully defend it. And that was my entree into politics. So my entree into politics was all about how people can change the outcome and how they're more powerful than anything else that we have. And then I got the privilege to work in lots of different political positions and for lots of people that I really admire, from Kathleen Sebelius, who was governor of Kansas and then later Secretary of Health and Human Services, to lots of other great candidates across the country, to being the D.C. Chief of Staff on the Hill for Patrick Murphy from Florida. I got to learn a lot of different things and hone a lot of different skills, and this feels like going home. This job feels like I'm back in a place where it's all about people power over special interests or big interests or those who normally get to have the voice and the power in our system. And I feel like if there's one truth in my life, it's that I like to challenge who gets to have power in our society, who gets to have a voice. And so I feel like this was a really natural fit for that.
That's beautiful and really resonates with me because I have a lot of family in Kansas. I was actually born in Kansas. And I have a lot of family in Missouri.
Really? Where at?
I was born in Kansas City, Kansas, I was born in Kansas City, Missouri, but lived in Kansas City, Kansas, in Overland Park.
Awesome.
But I do have a cousin right now
there's
at Washburn.
A really good race there, so. This cycle.
Oh, we should fly. Let's fly in school. And meet. but it really, what you just said really resonates because I have a lot. I have 36 cousins, you know, all throughout that area, and some of like I remember introducing my cousin who was 24 to his first gay couple. And I was like, how did you get to 24 and not meet a gay couple? And he was like, I don't know. I've been in Missouri the whole time, you know? So it was, I think there's something really powerful, speaking of power, of what you just said about really the true authentic connection between people and feeding that those early stories into your current job. I think that's really beautiful.
And on that note, Tiffany, I just want to ask, you know, so where are we right now in our fight to end Citizens United, and, you know, what are the next steps? And also, to add on to that, how can people, you know, listening right now, how can they get involved and join that fight to end Citizens United?
Well, first, what we need to do is win in November up and down the ballot. We can actually get real change to happen if we have the right leaders in place. And we need leaders who are going to have the integrity and the spine to stand up to special interests and to make this about giving our democracy back to the people. So first, please go to, and this is how people can get involved too, go to endcitizensunited.org. Please sign up and join us. Become part of our 4 million plus family. And then additionally, take a look at the candidates that we've endorsed across the country. Find someone who's local. Go knock doors. Go make phone calls. Most importantly, we need you to vote in November, and we need you to get your friends and your family to vote in November too. We can actually take back our democracy. It just takes all of us working together to do it.
And I feel like that's such a brilliant statement right there. We can all do it. And as we said on this podcast before, also go to vote.org. Make sure you're registered to vote. It's never too late to do it. You just have to get it done before your state deadline. So maybe there is a point where it is too late. But regardless, you need to register to vote. It is very important. Tiffany, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. We greatly appreciate you spending your time talking to us about this very important issue. Again, everyone, go ahead, Tiffany.
This has been wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on. And thank you to all the listeners as well.
Hey, I'm super excited for this week's Spotlight interview because it touches on another topic we haven't really dug into very much. So earlier this season, we started off with food waste. Last season, we did a couple things about fracking, but our Spotlight Org this week is about everyone deserving healthy air and what air pollution is doing. So stay tuned.
Hi, my name is Michael Hansen. I am the executive director of GASP. We're a Birmingham, Alabama-based nonprofit advocacy organization. Our mission is to reduce air pollution through education and advocacy. You can connect with us online at gaspgroup.org. That's GASPGROUP.org. And you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, etc. And our handle on all of our social media is GASP Group, just like our website. Some of our biggest successes so far have been advocating for environmental justice in the Birmingham, Alabama area, particularly as it relates to a Superfund site in northern Birmingham. We've made a documentary called Toxic City, Birmingham's Dirty Secret, that we released in 2014, and it's been shown thousands of times online, and it's been seen by hundreds, if not thousands, of viewers in in-person screenings throughout the city. And just recently, a lot of national attention has focused on this Superfund site and what needs to be done to secure a healthy community for the residents of Northern Birmingham. And so we continue to work on that today. Three ways that we ask people to get involved are, one, become a member. You can do that online at gasgroup.org. Two, volunteer. Again, you can sign up to volunteer on our website. And three is advocate. And we have campaigns on both our website and our social media every day that we're pushing out. Things ranging from climate change and clean energy actions to environmental justice to government accountability. So please look for those actions that you can take on our social media, particularly on our Facebook and on our website. That's about it. Thank you very much.
And that's it for this week's episode of We Rebel podcast. As always, please feel free to contact us if you have any questions for the two of us or our guests at werebelpodcast@gmail.com.
And you can find us on all the social medias at We Rebel Podcast, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
See everybody next week.
Yeah, when you hear a beat like that and you're listening to a Campfire Media podcast, you know you are listening to Dopetown 3000. Dopetown 3000, a nonstop hip-hop improv team bringing you a podcast. And what happens on that podcast? We bring on a guest, they tell a dope story, and we turn that dope story into a dope one-act radio play full of sounds, beats, and dopeness. Check it out on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are heard. Dopetown.
Campfire.